Hi, this is Leonard Peikoff answering questions emailed to me about Ayn Rand's philosophy of objectivism. I take questions of general interest, not technical philosophy and not practical politics. I do this every week or two and post it on my website. It's also available on iTunes. If you want to ask me a philosophical question, feel free. Just send it to leonard@peikoff.com. And my last name is Peikoff, P as in Peter, E-I-K-O-F-F as in off. Is it moral? Is it against objectivism to listen to a sad song when you feel unhappy? Or to look at The Scream, that's a painting by Edvard Munch, which I actually saw in person on a trip. Well, the question in regard to sadness, to take that first, obviously rests on a widespread dogma among some young objectivists that in order to be what Ayn Rand called benevolent, you can have only positive emotions, and that it's always wrong to feel sad or unhappy or cry, etc. That is totally mistaken. You can feel sad for many legitimate reasons, that you have lost a value, that you miss somebody. I mean, I don't have to itemize those. That is not an immoral issue. And you can very well want to hear something sad at that time. Or you may be perfectly happy, but there are certain pieces of music that are exquisitely beautiful, and you want to hear that music. And you can't feel guilt over the fact that you have an emotion like sadness that you want to feel or hear expressed. It has nothing to do with morality. Now, if all you want is unhappy music, then you might say you have a negative view of the world. But even so, there's nothing much you can do about it. And so long as you're acting, you should not feel guilty about that. And anyway, you know, our knowledge of music is not objective yet. So what one person hears as happy, another may feel as sad, and vice versa. So you have to be careful that you really are listening to what you think you're listening to, so far as you can tell. Now, The Scream is a pretty far-out sadness, if you call it that. If you look at that, as I did, and you are able to say, yes, that resonates. That's not just a mood of sadness. That is me, and that is life. Then I don't say that's necessarily immoral, but it would tell me that I would not care to befriend a person that has that kind of fundamental response. I would want to know if you think life is that horrible, that miserable. This is, I mean, like the essence of the modern art nihilist viewpoint. I don't think he should be an objectivist. So I don't put sad song or Munch. Now, I don't say that it's wrong to watch him, look at his painting, but I'm talking about if you can sink right into it and feel, boy, that's life, then, boy, you should spend your time with Picasso and all the rest of them. If the definition of self-sacrifice is to give away a value, but a value is a thing that you act to gain or keep, how can you both give away and keep something at the same time? Now, when you act as a human being, you always have some goal. The definition of sacrifice is that you surrender a higher value to a lesser value in your own standards. When you sacrifice, you're still acting to an end. You still have a purpose. But here you are deliberately choosing the lesser end by your own definition. So you give up your stronger desire, for example, to become a doctor in order to gain a not strong value of dutifully staying home to look after your lonely mother, which you accept because you're told to, even though You don't even spend time with people, get nothing out of their approval. You're just sacrificing. You're giving up in order to foster another one. There's no impossibility there. How can you support Israel, a nation whose essence is founded on a religion? Well, support doesn't mean support for the religion. It means defend them as the only Western culture in the entire region and as our only military ally. Not defend any of their, Israeli clannishness or Hebraic religion, but as our co-defenders against something that is much more, much worse in regard to religion and racism, and that is the anti-West militant Arabs. Now, if Israel were the fundamentalist, the Jewish fundamentalist, and they exist, I actually met one a few weeks ago, then it would be the same as the Arabs. But those fundamentalists do not control Israel the way their equivalents do the Arab world. Now, a question about the end of the fountainhead. Is Rourke counting on the rational judgment of the jury? Is a person always justified in believing that some rational remnant remains among men so as to stake one's life on this? No, if you mean by count, he expects them to act on it and he's behaving because of that expectation. No, he is uncertain of the result when he goes in. He even says, if you find me guilty, then I'll give my life in jail. He did pick the jury carefully. And remember, he's doing this many decades ago. But he would do it even if the jury were something he knew to be bad because he found it intolerable to go on and he wants his statement on the record. It's not necessarily obligatory on you to do this, but that was his choice and he was prepared to accept the consequences. Now the questioner says, are you always justified in believing some rational remnant remains? No, absolutely not. It altogether depends on the era or the country, the culture, the venue, etc. There's just about one place in the world where you can be guaranteed to be let off, and that's in Southern California, as the trials here demonstrate. But that's not because they're rational, but on the contrary, because they're irrational. Not all of them, just the jurors. In response to your claim that thinking is all that is needed to save the world, Nazi scientists used reason and thinking to almost develop the atomic bomb before we did. Well, you are taking my statement out of context. I didn't say, for instance, thinking about chess is all that's needed. I'm thinking about the fundamentals of life and what that implies as against accepting them on faith, a la religion, or being skeptical and doing nothing or doing whatever anybody feels because thought is irrelevant. If you think that way, then that's all that is needed to save the world. But there are plenty of anti-life concretes on which a person can make logical connections and thus be said to think. Criminals who think for a year on how to rob a bank, that's the same as the Nazi scientists. They have a delimited means to end thinking. But when I say thinking, I don't mean any structure of logic, no matter for what or in what context. You say we should go by reason first and then emotion. Think and then feel and act accordingly. But without emotion, what will you base your reason on? My answer is you base it on observation, on facts, In other words, on reality. That is, your only direct contact with reality is observation of what's out there. That's the only basis for any form of cognition or mental formation. It's the only possible source of value judgments, or therefore emotions. Until you see something you know, you can decide good or bad or have any feelings. Now, your process is you acquire certain elementary knowledge, you then lead to certain elementary desires, and then it becomes more sophisticated as you go. But the desire does not start you off, nor does it continue you in the process. Just because, for instance, you place a great value on getting an advanced degree, that does not make you think. Your desire will not start the thinking process, nor will your desire for truth by itself keep you objective. You must act in such a way as to always direct your consciousness to the facts. If you said, well, I'm letting my desire begin or direct my process of thought, and until then I won't think, how do you know what your desire is? How do you know what to give into until you've become focused and prepared for thought? So you can't ask for emotion to motivate consciousness. Now, I suggest you read Opar in my book where I discuss this at some length. Now, this question, I assume, comes from a young person. I don't feel comfortable in my own skin. I'm unhappy with my body, and this leads to very low self-esteem. I want to be found desirable, and I believe no one will. And he explains in the process that he's not ugly, he's not overweight, he exercises, he's more or less toned. So I say, who do you want to be desirable to? A good woman, yes, will be attracted to a good body, but that will not be the only or primary consideration. She'll be attracted to your mind, your personality, your fundamentals, your sense of life, as Ayn Rand calls it. And if she feels an affinity with this, then within a reason, your physical deficiencies will not be important to her. Now, you say that you have a normal body, but it doesn't lead to self-esteem. Well, of course, a body cannot lead to self-esteem. Self-esteem is evaluation of yourself as competent to perceive, judge, and evaluate the facts of reality and then act accordingly. It's an issue of judging your mind, of trusting your mind, of saying, I esteem my faculty of thought and valuing, and therefore corresponding action, because that is the self. As part of that, you want to have a good body, but a body alone is, without a mind, is meat. And that will get you, certain kinds of women, but that's all. You can be a cripple with a good mind and have self-esteem and be desirable. But you can also have the body of a Greek god and be a dolt, and then you won't have much of a woman desiring you unless that's the kind of woman you want. If you want people to be excited when they see your body, you have to first want them to be excited when they contact your mind, your spirit. If you want to know more about Ayn Rand's philosophy, I invite you to ask me a question. I can't answer them all, but I do read them all. Just write to leonard@peekoff.com. And if you haven't already done so, start by reading Ayn Rand's two most famous novels, The Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged. Thanks for listening.